Good afternoon and welcome to the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee meeting of January 26th. We'll call that to order. And Representative Johnson, have you reviewed the minutes? Would you like to move those?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move approval of the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. All right. Well, welcome back. And we have the opportunity to have Commissioner Zelli with us today, and we're going to start right out with that. And Commissioner Zelli, if you could come down. Oh, there you are. Thank you. And Commissioner Zelli is here today to give us an overview of the department. He will be back on the
February 11th,
so we will have another opportunity to visit probably many, and we appreciate you being here, Commissioner. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's a great honor to be here. The last time I testified on an overview of MnDOT, I had been on the job about 26 hours, and hopefully now after 2 years I know a little bit more, but we'll find out.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Oh, however you want to proceed, Commissioner, you have the floor.
Wonderful. Well, I do have a PowerPoint deck, and again, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee today, and this is going to be a general overview, and much of it might be facts and figures that you are very familiar with, but please feel free to interrupt me if some of this is new to anybody, and you'd like more background information. I should say I'm also joined by Deputy Commissioner Tracy Hatch, who's sitting close by, so if there's deeper financial questions, I may refer to her. Okay. But also, I know that the committee has some specific questions, which I will be addressing later in the PowerPoint, and then I'll try to go through this pretty quickly and leave time for questions or general conversation as we move ahead.
Commissioner, then would you prefer to go through your presentation and then for us to hold our questions until the second part, or how would you like to proceed?
You know, I'm actually fine either way. If we could have time for questions at the end, but if anybody has a clarifying question or something that you'd like to talk about right while I'm in the middle of a presentation, I have no problem being interrupted. And
okay, great. Thank you. We'll proceed that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, and I'll move quickly through some background information. As everybody knows, although we have had a highway department for, you know, nearly a century, the actual department was formed in the 70s, which is really a kind of a joining of all the departments that had the word transportation. But it's actually fairly significant, and you'll see this later on, that we have not just a highway department. We are multimodal. We have an aeronautics division. We have very much of a planning function. We don't just maintain the highway systems, but we actually plan for and build out the state system. We provide a number of services for county and municipal and township jurisdictions. I think this is an important slide. I actually participated in the long-term 50-year visioning planning process that MnDOT conducted over about 3 years ago called Minnesota Go. And we really developed a vision based upon citizen surveys, citizen focus groups, a guiding committee. And the long and short of it is that I'd like to say it turns out what is most important about transportation to Minnesotans actually isn't the modes of transportation themselves. It is about the way we live our lives, about our economic prosperity, about our quality of life. And so we've actually adopted as an agency this renewed vision that came out of a lot of that work. So I refer often to the multimodal transportation system that maximizes the health of people, the environment, and the economy. It isn't actually about concrete and bridge spans. It's about getting people from here to there in an affordable and efficient way. We, of course, do have a mission to build, plan, and maintain this multimodal system, and we think we have a great heritage of doing just that. We have core values, and this is something that it really runs across many agencies. The focus on accountability, but also diversity and inclusion, is not just the right thing to do. We actually are facing many retirements over the next 4 to 5 years. And so the idea of actually having our own workforce and our contractors reflect the changing faces of Minnesota itself, and to ensure that we actually have a workforce in the next 5-10 years, we have to start now recruiting and making our whole culture within the department more inclusive. So I'll just spend a little bit of time talking about this organizational chart. I'm sorry some of these slides might seem fairly small and hard to read, but I'm welcome to we pass them out so you can see that on your paper. When I came 2 years ago, we had a commissioner and then a deputy commissioner and then about 17 people reporting to that deputy commissioner. So you'll see this is somewhat different. We have five people reporting to me. We have two deputy commissioners. In addition to Tracy Hatch, who's the chief operating officer, chief financial officer, who I just introduced. Susan Mulvihill is the other deputy commissioner and chief engineer, and Sue's sitting right over here on the right. Most of the employees of MnDOT really report to the chief engineer position. We have five operating divisions that really report to those two deputy commissioners, not just the multimodal aeronautics, freight, transit, passenger rail, and a planning function, but much of our then all of our districts through our operations division are really there, and those seven different districts report to our operations director. We also have engineering services, so all that is reporting to our chief engineer. Through Tracy Hatch, we have both the administration side of the business as well as state aid. Our new state aid director is with us today, Mitch Rasmussen, who's in the audience, way in there. And we know that we do more than just pass money along to counties and municipalities. We actually very much part of setting standards and providing assistance along the way. So that's a very robust part of our division. But in addition, we have a chief counsel reports to me. She actually manages the Office of Civil Rights. We have an assistant commissioner for policy, which is part of our government relations, who actually is new to the department, Sean Ron, who's also in the room. In addition, our chief of staff, Eric Davis, who manages a lot of our external communications and customer relations activity. So this group of six of us constitutes the executive committee of MnDOT. As I mentioned, we are actually divided into eight regional areas, seven in greater Minnesota, and then Minneapolis, St. Paul Metro District is all one division. In terms of the actual budget, the Metro Division, clearly the biggest, it's roughly half of the overall operating budget compared to the other districts. So if you're looking at the puzzle and you're wondering where District 5 is, that used to be the Metro. Now it's just Metro. So we think about MnDOT as not just highways and bridges, but and multimodal efforts, but it is a number of products and services. We, of course, are really, and maybe paramount activity is maintaining the actual state system. This is, of course, this time of year, that's plowing snow, but during the summer, it's a lot of repairing of culverts, guardrails, high-tension cables. I've had the great pleasure of actually riding along in a truck, and I realize that our workforce, which touches every part of the state of Minnesota, have great pride in how they manage this system. By evidence, the fact that the driver I was with often pointed to the cable tension wire that was loose or the sign that was not quite straight, and he'd said, "Those are my signs. That's my cable. I have to go back and take care of that." So I've been very impressed with the pride that our Minnesota employees have toward maintaining many times the systems in their own communities where they live. As I mentioned, we have a local roads division, but also multimodal systems. We think a lot about transit. We think about the metro area. Well, in fact, Greater Minnesota Transit is part of MnDOT. It's a very important part of our program where we help facilitate and provide funding, along with federal funding, for some of the regional transit systems, both small communities and large. And as part of the state aid division, they actually manage a program called ARMOR, which is the series of emergency towers and radio communications. So that is actually part of MnDOT, is maintaining, building out and maintaining the emergency armor system, which is used by many counties, jurisdictions, and tribes. This is a new slide for MnDOT. What is the state system? You think about these 12,000 miles around the state, and it's only 12,000 out of some 140,000 miles of roadway that's in the state of Minnesota. And it's pretty comprehensive. Even though it's only 12,000 miles, these are the major arteries. We handle as much as close to 60% of the actual vehicle traffic is in this state system. So it has the highest standards, but the highest use. So then you look at our municipal aid streets. These are the cities. And, of course, it's, again, all over the state of Minnesota, the municipal roadways. A much more robust system is our county state aid highways. This is nearly 30,500 miles. And you can see from the map, there's a lot more miles and in every jurisdiction. And as I might point out, in varying states of condition. Township, even more. We can see 55,000 miles in these smaller towns and it gets really blurry, but this is this could be everything from a gravel road to an asphalt road to nearly private roads. So when people describe Minnesota as having the fifth largest transportation road system in America, it is really these maps that show that it's not just because we're an agricultural state. We've just had a long tradition of a very complex and interconnected roadway system. And with as many lakes, as culverts as we have, we are the land of some 12 or 20,000 bridges. Here they are all laid up together, so it's 142,000 miles of roadway all together. As I mentioned, 57 billion annual miles of travel on all of our trunk highways, or on all of our highways, 33 billion of that, the vast majority, is on the state system. About 4,800 of the bridges are on state highways, and those are the bridges of our primary concern in terms of maintaining the condition. But of course, we have state inspectors and state standards for all bridges. Aviation is a critical part of our economy in our state. We have 135 airports, including the 9 commercial airports. Which is a vast system, and I have learned how many of the airports, although not part of commercial air service, are essential to the economy of many rural areas, businesses, and communities. So our aeronautics division does a lot of coordinating of investments and standards for all those publicly registered state-funded airports. When I say they're state-funded, they're not all state airports, certainly. They're owned by communities, some private, generally municipal or county airports. The water freight, which is a big part of, has always been part of agriculture and mining, but it actually now is evolving to cover all commodities and products from across the state. 60 million tons shipped in the Great Lakes, 11 million by river. We are finding much of the congestion we're experiencing on freight rail actually spilling over to the waterways, but now we're experiencing congestion in our waterways, particularly last spring with the floods. We found limited time on the Mississippi, and that has actually now pushed pressure into highway freight. So one way to be thinking about this, even though many times MnDOT is organized, you could say, in silos, this is very much an integrated system. Particularly when you look at freight, it is both intermodal and it is sometimes pressure from one to the next. Public ports, Duluth, Winona, Red Wing, St. Paul, Minneapolis will be closing soon. As we all know, the lock at St. Anthony is closing. But Duluth is received a Tiger Grant this last year. The federal government is going through a major refurbishment and I think a great opportunity for the state of Minnesota for our shipping. This spring, and we'll actually have containerized shipping, not just large salties carrying ore, but containers going from trains to ships to the Great Lakes. I had the great honor of chairing a maritime task force for 8 Great Lakes states, and as well as 2 provinces from Canada, Ontario, and Quebec. And we see the Great Lakes as an opportunity for Minnesota as a way to get into more global shipping, frankly, around the world. The expansion of the Panama Canal actually affects Minnesota because having a deep water global port in this inland state is a remarkable asset, and I think we'll continue to, and we have additional capacity for shipping in that area. You've been already exposed to many of the freight rail issues and testimony, so I won't go on, but as you know, 20 railroads, 4 of which are Class 1 railroads. We have a very robust rail system in the state of Minnesota. Most of those are, well, they are all private companies. Most of the track is private as well. And is, I think, gone from a third-tier kind of issue to a frontier issue with all the, not just oil from North Dakota, but all commodities using freight. And we have significant safety and operating challenges, but it also shows the importance of that mode to our economy. I talked a little bit about transit, the 79 counties that have public transit as part of our rural program, and I certainly have to mention bicycle and pedestrian facilities throughout the state. We do have a bicycle and pedestrian division where we do more than just do planning. We've actually worked both on safe routes to schools and major bike routes throughout the state, but also help set a standard across the state for bike and pedestrian activity. We are actually probably the second state that will have a statewide pedestrian plan. A pedestrian plan is where we work with local communities, set standards and flexibility to know that bike and ped aren't just for recreation. This has been part of my own education, is how it actually affects the livability of communities and provides access as well as efficiency in how people kind of get around our state. And I say our state, not just the metro area. I've found the most energy about bicycle routes and new facilities in Greater Minnesota, in Bemidji and Austin and in other areas. Maybe all would like to be like Lanesboro, but it actually is part of the regular life of many small towns.
Commissioner, we do have one question in regards to that side. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioners Elliott. the 2 years of experience that is starting to show. I appreciate that. You're catching on quickly, so thank you. In regards to transit here, I noticed this specifically talks only about Greater Minnesota Transit, and I know that the Met Council has a fair amount of responsibility in the seven-county metro area transit. Is there a slide later to talk about what the department is involved with there, or do you have some other follow-up comment in regards to that?
Well, I can mention it now. I don't think we have a specific slide because, as you're correct, that is a Metropolitan Council jurisdiction. However, we do collaborate closely, both at the high level and at the engineer's level. When there's a certain build-out of projects, we often have our staffs assigned to a Metropolitan Council project, and likewise, we do a lot of our planning in concert. And as you know, the Metropolitan Council helps program a lot of the federal funds and activity within the metropolitan area for highways and bridges. We think of a lot of the MinPass lanes and other transit corridors as ones where, even though they are highway and bridge assets, ones that we maintain them in concert with a transit capacity point of view. So it's important, I think, for our view that that we can't think of them as siloed operations, that they actually have to be, in part for efficiency and for impacts, that they be highly coordinated and developing a wasteful kind of approach.
Mr. Petersburg. Just as a continuation of that, I highly agree, and I thank you so much for that, because I think, as complex as you've seen our transportation system, we are interdependent upon each other, and so I think it's important for us to always maintain those ability to work together and be impactful on the other. So thank you very much.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Good to see you again. Well, Commissioner, one thing piqued my interest here, and I know my constituents often ask me, we have roads and bridges in this state to build, and why are we building trains all over the place? And you and I have talked about that, and we will continue to, I'm sure. And then, of course, the question is, where is there not going to be a bicycle trail in the state? And we continue to see them, and I still have not seen an inventory of usage of those, or do we really have anybody using the ones we have? I think anecdotally you'll see some yeses and some noes with those, and a lot of noes probably, to the extent we maybe anticipate when we built some of them. But now we're seeing pedestrian activity. Can you tell us more about that? I just heard a little bit. So are we, like, drawing maps for people and telling them where to walk, or what are we doing?
Commissioner Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question, and I didn't mean to give a superficial account. A pedestrian plan, it actually isn't, here's the sidewalk, this should be, it's more to kind of set some standards and some best practices that can be helpful for mostly towns and municipalities, and frankly for our projects. When they intersect, say, main streets, we often, and we found some great advantages that when we are reconstructing a state highway through a town, which is a main street, if we deal with it only as a freight byway, we might actually disrupt the retail, the livability, the main street of that community. But by having standards that think about making sure that we can accommodate both the state highway needs, but also knowing that crosswalks, ways that signaling could be done better, safety widths, ways to calm or kind of make sure that the traffic moves consistently but maybe at a slower speed, that accommodates all interests. And the projects we have done, for instance, in St. Peter just last summer, we reconstructed the Main Street of Alexandria. We worked collaboratively with the city and the local Chamber of Commerce to make sure that we weren't killing the retail. We're actually enhancing the experience, but also doing the important repaving project as well. So the pedestrian plan is more about making sure that we're considering a lens that is broader in the context of all uses of the system, and to make sure that sometimes we're not creating barriers to parts of a city that we make sure we are actually providing access in ways that are meaningful. So it's less about creating new pedestrian spaces. It might actually, in the case of Alexandria, one side of the street has a much wider sidewalk. Turns out that planned with great interest on the part of the chamber and the city of Alexandria, and we are able to put all of our funds together, even while they are redoing their utility systems in a way that seemed more efficient. Once we kind of, so we closed down the road at one time. It's a way of thinking of it is rather than just go in curb to curb, go in building to building and make sure it's designed more holistically. I guess that's the best way I can describe that approach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. The way you describe it puts me at ease. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again, Commissioner. My question goes back to this same slide, but up in the ports, because you mentioned container operations, and maybe you can help clarify something, because when I asked that question about containers to the port authorities when they were here, they kind of downplayed the idea that a lot of containers were going to move. So can you elaborate on that and kind of clear that up for me as far as what you see as container operations in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, they would be much greater authorities than I am, but my understanding is that this is a pilot program to actually check the feasibility of whether this might be a viable shipping opportunity. And so I believe that we should be open to that kind of alternative, because having freight choices and the fact that freight is becoming less large commodities and more kind of niche-y business. So if you take a grain company, they might actually be shipping a specific kind of grain to a country in Asia as opposed to just a general commodity. So I think containers is not a wholesale shift in strategy. It's just more of an incremental, that tool or that opportunity may be part of our port system in the future.
Representative Howe?
Okay.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We can move on. If Representative Drazkowski is reassured about pedestrian investments, then I'm reassured. So I was just going to make a point about that, but we can move on.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Commissioner Zelli, please continue.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I apologize. We did have one more question.
Thank you, Runbeck. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while you're on the topic of a little bit of transit, so in the metro area where you've got the Met Council and MnDOT, and you've got trunk highways that have their own dedicated funding and so on and so forth, I mean, is there a lead agency when it comes to what's going to be done with a particular trunk highway?
Commissioner Zelli.
How does that all work?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, it is actually kind of a combination. There's no question that throughout the state of Minnesota, we use our performance measures, we use our kind of central quantitative way of determining what needs rehabilitation, what needs more mobility. But we always work with local jurisdictions, local transportation advisory committees. So in the metro area, you know, really driven by federal requirements, we have the Metropolitan Council as our local metropolitan planning organization. So we do go through the process with the Transportation Advisory Board, the TAB, to help set priorities and about where our investments go. But that is really more driven by, again, the federal process. Since actually most of our construction money comes from state sources, we have some flexibility. And I think we kind of view our relationship as very cooperative and not necessarily one that's diametrically opposed in terms of objectives. And if there's issues that we have felt strongly about, for instance, adding a general purpose lane in 494 last year, we did not find that. We found some concern because that didn't fit into the longer range vision of the TAB. We found greater acceptance and understanding because that was something our metric show was important. So I think it's been a give and take, and it's not driven by one or the other.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please continue, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Well, I'll talk just a little bit about the use of the system, what we see going forward. This is just a very top view. Tourism continues to be a rising need and interest in this state of Minnesota. It's really affecting our systems. I'm always proud to say that although I'm not a I'm not an engineer, and I'm not the first commissioner who's not been an engineer, I am the first commissioner who is a registered travel agent, so those who have an interest. And I recognize that it's had substantial economic benefit, both to urban areas and to many of our rural destinations. You know, you think about vehicle miles as being kind of flat, although we don't say this is a bullet point. You know, we don't see vehicle miles as increasing statewide a lot, maybe 1 or 2% a year. But freight traffic really is increasing, and I think this 30% figure might, in fact, even be underestimating it. Because what we've seen, not just from, you know, businesses in North Dakota, which, by the way, are all shipping east, doesn't seem like they're going west. They're coming through Minnesota, and that's not just rails, it's highways. But you'll see it from our robust economy. Our manufacturing businesses are increasing, and products and services are kind of, as manufacturing comes back to the United States and to into Minnesota, we're finding that the shipping needs for many of those businesses have increased as well. We talked about rail traffic, and of course there is a population that's coming to Minnesota, and many of those are using the transportation system in different ways than that they traditionally have. Okay, here's a quick slide. No shock here. Turns out we have a system which is deteriorating over time. 50% of our pavements are over 50 years old, and roughly a third of our bridges are over a half a century old, and so over time they degrade, and we refurbish, and then occasionally we have to replace those structures and assets. And what compounds it is, of course, our weather extremes. I've heard it said that we're the ninth most extreme climate in the United States, which I find curious because I'm wondering who 1 through 8 is. I can't imagine that anything could be as more harsh than our own environment. Not just snow and ice, but obviously flooding, which we've had more frequency of flooding, including last spring. And as you can see, our snow and ice, maybe we got a break this year, but sometimes it's actually the frequency of snowfalls that causes us the greatest cost, not just the depth of the snowfalls. Last 2 years, we had that amazing amount of work for MnDOT, and that just comes out of the bottom line of our agency, $136 million. Cost last year for snow and ice operations when we really budget for a medium year, which is $80 million. And we actually make a conscious decision to spend the money. In the past, it comes out of just one maintenance budget, and you'll be getting deeper into these facts this session. But when we, in the past, have taken a huge hit on snow and ice, it really affects the amount of guardrails and culvert repairs and other work that we're doing in the summer. And as a business person, I find that incredibly frustrating because, you know, good maintenance actually saves lives and saves money farther down the way. We did get an appropriation, but just from our trunk highway reserves last spring to fill in some of the extra costs we spent last winter. When I say we consciously spend the money, we had one snowfall last year where one weekend there was that perfect storm. We've had a number of perfect storms. But it came in, and then the temperature was kind of warm, and then it got cold so that the slush freezes and the salt doesn't work as well. And we actually, as they say, put everything on it. We had overtime, we used outside contractors, we used all the salt that we could find, and we actually cleared the state in a matter of 36 hours. Well, that weekend cost us $20 million out of this 136 was just one storm. But we recognize at that same time there were national news items about the storms in Georgia where people were leaving their cars in the middle of highways. And we could recognize the costs, the economic costs and disruption to our state far exceed that $20 million that we spent. And for those of you who have family or friends in New York or Massachusetts, we'll probably be seeing some of those pictures in the next day. It is 2 feet of snow is not handled well in many states, and we're really very proud of the fact that we do handle that. And part of the reason is because it's too expensive not to. So snow and ice is kind of our highest priority of where money goes. We will always kind of take care of it because we think that has the highest return.
Excuse me, Commissioner, again, we do have a few more questions before we move on. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner Zelli, thank you for being here today. A couple of questions for you. One, on your slide 15, you said that you're projecting nearly 1 million new Minnesotans by 2040. Do you have any projection as to where they're going to be living in the state, or are you using Met Council data, or how are you arriving at that million, and where are you saying that they're going to be living, and what roads will they be driving on, I guess, would be one question.
You know, I don't have a specific answer. I know that part of this data came from the Met Council, also from the state demographer. I think primarily it is in the metro area, primarily, but it's not only in the metro area. But I think we do see more population coming to the regional centers. So that's been an ongoing trend, which is one of the reasons we've had the Corridors of Commerce program is to think about these major arteries between regional centers as being critical for the growth of the state's economy.
Mr. Chair, thank you. One more question, Commissioner Zelli. You were talking about the perfect storm of last year, and I do remember that having I was the mayor of a metro city, and one of the questions I have is you're utilizing a large budget item of salt and sand chemical mix. Has MnDOT begun looking at what we did in Waconia, which is a utilization of brining more as a statewide program? And if you could maybe detail that for the body here.
Commissioner Zelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash. We are having a combination of brine and hard salt, and my understanding, and I mean, I'm just a simple bus guy, so I'm your user, but I know that you know, it depends on the weather conditions and what is anticipated. For instance, pre-marinating the road, it sounds like a nice, fine salad, but that works much better in anticipation of snow and ice, as opposed to having trucks stuck in the middle of rush hour and not being able to go anywhere and apply salt. So I always think it's a combination. One of the things that I think has been really helpful for MnDOT's budget is the use of a much more sophisticated system within the trucks, both a GPS system, so we actually know exactly what has been deployed and where, so that we're not duplicating the coverage of any kind of surface application, either sand, salt, or brine, and we're able to actually save a substantial amount and to make sure that we're only using what we need to use, because of course salt is not favorable to the environment, it's not favorable to our cars, so we try to do the job but do it with as least as possible. So I think there's more technologies, frankly, that I think would be helpful for us to make sure that we're using what we have, you know, wisely. It's always it's one of our big budget items, no question.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. I would really encourage the department to work with some of the municipalities. Sometimes in the outer rings, we were able to lower our costs for salt sand by 70% in the city of Waconia. Tremendous savings to the taxpayer and with higher results. So, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative. That's great. Thank you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, always a pleasure. Yeah, you've touched on it a little bit in terms of technology, and my question relates to, you know, new technologies. Are there new technologies and new products coming out for highway paving, whether it be asphalt, concrete, or something as simple as highway striping and marking paint, where we're going to be able to achieve some cost savings because of increased longevity. Is there anything new on the horizon there?
Commissioner Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. I think that there's continuing research, and this is why we invest in research, both with pools with other states who actually have invested in a lot of our Min Road operations where we test pavements. This is up on 94. If anybody has not had a tour or have an interest in learning what we do, both at our research labs in Roseville but also at Min Road, I really invite you to and let me know, because I think it's really instructive. Both asphalt and concrete technology is evolving. We're finding ways ways to improve on the past. We also find some of the pavements that were deployed in the 60s last really long. Some that were deployed in the 80s, not so long. So we're learning from past errors. One of the things that I'm thrilled at is that we're actually working on a joint venture with a testing facility in Alabama. We're actually, with the combination of Min Roads for a cold weather environment and then a warm weather environment, we actually get more efficiency by collaborating with some other states. We learned that we could probably do it with Alabama because we've been doing it very successfully with some Scandinavian countries. I just signed an agreement, a cooperative agreement with Norway and Sweden and Finland to look at some of the technologies that they're doing in northern European countries to both analyze pavements, but also how they can really assess where work needs to be done. This is like radar and scanning equipment, looking at what is underneath the surface, because of course it's what's going on underneath the surface that really comes to get you, not just the pothole on top. By the time the pothole comes, it's too late.
Thank you. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, that's kind of the vein I was going down, because I, Representative Hornstein got us, as he was chair last year, got us to out there to see that test facility, and it's a great thing. I think we ought to do that again. But as we look at that, I sometimes question the stats that say we got less than a three-year life. I'd kind of like to have you expound on how we identify what has a three-year life, what has a five-year life, and if that's being successful, what we've learned, and we're saving money off of that test facility, is there anything to do, any thought to do something like that with bridges? Because I think there's a lot to be said for learning stuff of bridges, because I've driven all over the world, and some bridges were built in the 1800s, and I drove the biggest trucks the Army have across those bridges. So new technology, like you just said, is not always better. So what are we doing to try and learn better ways and how we can save money and longer life spans on the bridge technology?
Mr. Zell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, thank you for that. I believe, again, sharing research and learning both innovative construction techniques, but what works, what doesn't work, and is really worthwhile. We have a great fortune of having a history of innovation and some good kind of work within MnDOT, and I think we're continuing to find ways that we can advance that work. I think that bridges like the Hastings Bridge that just opened this last year is a good example of an innovative design, not just in how it was constructed. Of course, for those that aren't familiar, it was constructed on the side of the river and actually floated in. But the actual design itself is a very, very large span, but it's stainless steel, uses a little more expensive materials. But that'll be a 100-year bridge. I mean, that will last, our estimation is, quite a bit longer, in part because we were very careful about how, and thoughtful about how those materials that have been tested in other places could perform. So I think that, again, the commitment to research, and not just innovation, but testing it with other states and other countries. We're actually on most of the engineering ASHTO, which is our trade association committees, to kind of make sure that we're following at least some best practices, and sometimes there's a balance between cost and return on some of those investments.
Okay, thank you, members. Just to be respectful of the presentation the commissioner put together, I think we will hold off on questions for a while and allow the commissioner to get through the report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll march right along, and I want to touch on, and not in deep detail, but just give a sense of where the sources and uses of our entire budget. This slide really shows that our sources aren't coming really from one place. We keep talking about fuel taxes, but that's 28% of our budget. It's not there's a diversified portfolio of fees. The major state fees, of course, the motor vehicle sales tax, fuel tax, and the registration fees. Federal aid is actually, as you see, 16% of our entire budget if you count bond proceeds. 23% if you take the local, so it's 23%. But that's probably less than many states. But it's also for our construction programs, the $1 billion or so of our state construction budget, or roughly half of that really comes from that federal sources. So it is, even though it looks smaller in terms of its source, it's a bigger part of our construction program. As you can see on the spending side, full third is passed on to local transportation through the state aid programs. And then the bulk, largest part of our program is the state road and bridge construction program. We have both operations and multimodal system. This is including all uses and all sources. Some of this is general fund. It's not all trunk highway funds. As you know, that transit and any of those modes cannot constitutionally be paid from the trunk highway fund. That is restricted only to roads and bridges. Many of you have seen this before. This is the highway tax distribution fund. As I mentioned, these various funding sources that go to the trunk highway fund, which is the state system, but also is distributed to counties, municipalities. Then 5% has some flexibility in terms of what goes to our town bridges and our flexible highway account. And Commissioner Landauer is always first to say that some of the revenue that's generated from snowmobiles and small vehicles in state parks goes back to the benefit of DNR. And I guess I've touched on this. This is an important slide to consider, and for this committee, is the amount of funding that's required for debt service, both for past debt. We've issued a number of bonds over the past 5 years, and we would expect that we will be pretty much at our debt capacity in the next couple of years. This is the two forecasts in the past year. The red line is the end of session that we always do at the end of the session of where is our forecast in future years. Considering both our debt payments but also the debt issuances, we have some major projects that will continue to be funded through and have already been programmed with trunk highway bonds. St. Croix Crossing would be a good example of a major project that where we will continue to release and issue bonds. Our last issue is in November, so we did a reforecast, and as you can see, interest rates have come down, and we have paid down some debt. So that blue line shows that we're actually saving some on debt service. However, if you see that 2017-2018 period, it really kind of comes together, and that's about the time we're reaching our debt limit. Our debt limit being the policy of 20% of our existing revenues to be associated with debt service. Here's our management policy, the 20% of our revenues being attributed to debt service. And with that forecast, another way of looking at it, you can see that 2017-2018 period is when we, when our debt peaks under existing projects, but we're still under that threshold. So here's a way to kind of look at the history over the past 14 years of how we've actually funded construction. This is not all our budget. This is what is the state highway, road, and bridge construction sources of funding for that program. And it goes a little bit up and down. You can see that in the 2009-2010, we actually had ARRA stimulus funding. Quite a bit of borrowing, which was a little bit the result of the 2008 gas tax increase of 8.5 cents. It was programmed that 3.5 cents would be dedicated to debt service. In actuality, that's more like 5.5 cents that actually turned out. So quite a bit of that funding and increased revenues has been now dedicated to debt service. We had some recently with these quarters of commerce bonds that where we realized we had that incremental debt capacity from that 20% figure. So the legislature appropriated that $300 million. Not all that has been issued yet for those programs. So as you can see, the forecast over the next few years, we're dropping considerably, even with that additional trunk highway bonds that'll be continue to be issued as part of that that existing program. So here's looking at the future and the out years. With the solid blue is by adjusting the actual recurring revenue that we know we have with a 5% inflation factor, which is what we've consider both highway construction is a reasonable estimate. But here's both in real terms and in inflation-adjusted terms. So we talked a lot about the funding gap, and my guess is we'll be talking about that for a couple of months. But here's a quick overview, both in terms of what it takes to modernize or preserve the existing system, which our arithmetic comes out to approximately $4 billion over the next 10 years, and then a strategic expansion investment gap of $2 billion. So for a total gap of $6 billion, over the course of 10 years. And we think this is consistent, not exactly the same, but consistent with a lot of the findings of the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee from 2 years ago. We've learned a lot even since then, but the general direction is very consistent. One difference might be the issue of preserving the existing system or modernizing it. When we modernize the system, much like we've done with 35E this last year and we'll continue to do next year, is we might be repaving a roadway that hasn't been touched in 50 years. But as we're in there, we've actually replaced bridges. We've actually made them more accessible, and we've improved the actual asset. When we replaced the Lafayette Bridge, we actually replaced it with two bridges, much higher quality of construction. It will last, again, probably 100 years. Is two bridges, not just one. It is not fracture critical, which means that it has redundant systems to hold it up. If one part fails, Lafayette new bridge will stand, not like the old one. And it also accommodates possible expansion in the future, but also has flexibility that if you're maintaining and closing one bridge, going one direction, you can actually get both directions on one of the remaining bridges, which is currently kind of what we're doing now under construction. So when we say we are preserving a system, we're actually, in reality, we're modernizing it. We're not necessarily building a greater capacity, not expansion, but they are better and more state-of-the-art and have more environmental standards built in as well. So here's a big I always think this this slide we could come back and talk about, and we should. It should be ultimately expanded to 8 slides. But it really is the question that we've gotten from the business community and from many stakeholders, and from many of you, is at different levels of funding over the next 10 years, what happens? And this is just a quick kind of a summary. But as you can see, with no additional funding, we would expect 75% more miles, around 4,000 miles, to be in poor condition in the next 10 years. As many as 640 bridges will be in poor condition. That's 20% of our bridges. We will not be doing the build-out of MinPass lanes, except for maybe one or two within the metro area. So there is some expansion built in. We will do many of the existing corridors of commerce program projects, but the work that we've done to buy right-of-way and do some preliminary engineering, those could not be completed without additional funding. We go back to that Transportation Finance Advisory Committee recommendation on maintenance. That's the $250 million a year. It does maintain it, but only by replacing pavements. It doesn't expand or modernize the existing system. That's why, that's the difference between the 250 a year versus the 400 million a year, which is really improving as much as 2,200 additional miles of pavement, 330 bridges up to standard. We think that in our pavement and asset models show that that it really is more than just pavement and bridges. We have culverts. We have some of the assets that are kind of adjacent to highways. We have to kind of look at it more comprehensively. Expansion is the additional $2 billion. This is primarily corridors of commerce. It's also when you look at such rehabilitation projects like I-94 between the two cities, we know that there's a major pavement work that needs to be done because it's eroding and it's 50 years old. But while we're there, there's major kind of environmental hydraulic work that needs to be done. And if we were to add a MinPass lane, that is an exceptional challenge, but it's certainly an opportunity. And once you're into a corridor with a major project, it is the time to look at a transit corridor expansion. So that is not in any part of our even first or second tier funding scenario. When I started 2 years ago, I said to myself, well, at least I won't have to be the guy that worries about I-94, but it turns out I am, because we are starting to study it now and realize that it's actually in pretty rough shape in many places, and you can experience that yourselves.
Commissioner, I apologize. I do have a question on that slide, though. There's two different reports, and you refer to the TFAC report. Just in regards to maintenance, and then I see it's economically competitive is in quotations, and I think around that time too we were talking about world class, and I'm just wondering, how did we make the decision, or how was that defined then throughout that process?
Well, you know, I remember the conversations at the time, because I was representing just as a business person on the committee. There was a lot of talk about how we have aspirations in Minnesota to be world class, but there was an equal amount of conversation on that committee saying, why would we want to be world class? Why can't we just be competitive with what the rest of the world is? Because world class sounds a little expensive and a little bit un-Minnesotan, and you know, who are we trying to be? And so it's really about language. I view world class as something which is kind of outside the bounds of competitive. It is like, wouldn't it be great if we could be leading the world? None of these scenarios are, in that respect, world class. World class meaning more highways in different regions, different parts of the state. So competitive is what I'm referring to, but it is, in honestly, it is described as competitive world class in the TFAC report itself. But the conversation around it was like, well, let's describe it as that, but it's really not that. So I haven't put it here on this slide as world class because I just don't believe it is. And we can get into more detail. I think competitive means it is prudent and can be verified with pretty specific arithmetic about what the projects are that add to either community life or our economy and have a very measurable return on investment. And I think the ROI, the return on investment themes within the TFAC report and what we've been looking at is really the strategy that we've been pursuing. Investments need to have actual measurable results as opposed to let's build something so that it might be worthy some future generation. But I think we have to look at the future generations, but economically competitive is kind of that measurable impact range.
So thank you. So in that regard, during the process, were we looking at infrastructure and economies similar to ours so that we did have comparisons there? Because quite frankly, Commissioner, what we're really, I think a lot of our task is to understand the need.
Right.
And we're going to be doing that throughout this process so that we can reach agreement on that. But we really do need to understand where those numbers are coming from and how that's derived.
Yeah, I think competitive is competitive with other states in the United States as a starter, and then we can kind of look at some other economies when you look at transit and other kind of multimodal choices. But I think there's two lenses. One is what's the most efficient in terms of the actual asset life itself that's there. How do you prudently invest and maintain what we have? Modernizing it would be really, also how do you kind of mitigate future costs from having to do it right? And then the second is the external economic impact. Does this affect adjacent businesses for congestion costs? Does it help attract and retain the workforce? Can you actually find what I would call external returns? And I think those are the areas in the way to kind of approach the look at the various investment levels.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Please continue.
So, just to give you a sense of what bridge conditions look like, we actually rebuilt Maryland Bridge this last summer as part of the I-35E reconstruction. So, there is a bridge life. Many times we'll redeck a bridge. We'll refurbish a bridge. We'll extend the life of a bridge. For instance, Botnick Bridge, a year ago, we finished a refurbishment, which means putting in more metal sheets, doing a lot of paint, actually kind of making sure that we could, and we actually put in lighting, which is a small part of the puzzle, but it was really about how do we extend the life of a really expensive bridge another 10, maybe 20 years so that you don't have to replace it, which is $180 to $200 million. And we know that refurbishment makes sense. But at some point, you actually, in the case of the I-35E, it was not just the bridge condition, it was the bridges, the way they were on top of the highway, it really precluded putting in more min-pass lanes. So it was kind of a confluence of reconstruction and improvement. The high bridge is scheduled for redecking in a couple of years. I was actually on a paddleford or a boat this last summer, and I was standing next to the our head bridge engineer, and I said, "Geez, Nancy, don't you feel proud of all these bridges? They look so great." And she said, "Well, don't look too closely underneath the high bridge, which we were about to go under, because you won't get as excited." And unfortunately, I did look pretty carefully, and I now think differently about driving across the high bridge. We do have a number of, I'm sorry, now I'm going to create alarm, but sometimes it's what you don't see is in terms of exposed rebar and flaking, and that can be addressed through decking, the bridge is safe, but the point is these bridges don't last forever. They have to take constant care, both maintenance, washing. We now wash our bridges every year because we know that salt goes in there and starts eating away that rebar, so it actually saves us money to make sure we wash those bridges every year, wash the salt that we sometimes MnDOT puts on the bridges for ice. But also, at the end of the day, we have to actually redeck the bridge, and then eventually, of course, all bridges don't last forever. So here's just some of the pictures of what we do, what our inspectors find. This person in the upper right corner is actually grinding down and is able to kind of determine whether there's any kind of dangerous cracks and what metal needs to be replaced. Some of these sheets are ways to reinforce existing structures so we can actually add structure to make sure that it's reinforced and not vulnerable. I'm going to look at my chief engineer. Tell me if I'm lying here. No. So far, so good. Okay, good. Again, sometimes it's cosmetic, but oftentimes our concern is what's underneath and really critical to the integrity of a bridge. We've, as many of you have read and heard me talk about, that enhancing our financial effectiveness is a huge priority for our agency. In fact, it's the number one priority. And we've had some, I think, pretty good track record in actually freeing up resources that we've deployed to other unfunded projects. We do that in three main areas, and I have to say every employee at MnDOT is involved in this what we call our wildly important goal, which is enhancing our financial effectiveness. And first, in our financial management, we need to do a better job, and we're really gotten there with the great work of our Chief Financial Officer, Tracy Hatch, who's like any business, we want to track our costs, our accurate costs, from all our various products and services, so we know what is it that we really are facing and what is the cost of our different programs. But again, the real cost savings probably come in two areas. One is this asset management models and our project management scoping and how we actually undertake projects. The asset management is, and I always describe it as that a road and a bridge is not so different from a bus. I spent my career managing buses where I know that they'll run 1.5 miles, but only if I do substantial refurbishment at about 750 miles. I'll replace the engine, redo the seats, redo the drivetrain, repaint it. It's best if that's done in a prudent way when it's the smart time to do it, because then you'll get that full 14-year life. And if you don't do it, then that bus is broken on the side of the road, and it frankly becomes even more expensive to try to repair what is and patch what is not been effectively managed. So our asset management models and our effort to really better understand how and when we should be managing our pavements, our bridges, all of our assets, so that we're not either doing it too much or too late, and that we're using the right technology in many cases, or deploying the financial return or financial benefit to that process. And we think with one of the best values of additional resources to make sure we're actually not squandering the funds, but we're actually extending asset life. And that's where part of our commitment to 15% of additional resources coming from our own efficiency is really driven in part by that. One thing we haven't measured, and I talked about external direct savings, but we take it seriously. We often spend more on a construction contract in order to keep lanes open because we know they're critical to an economy. Or in the case, like I mentioned, the Hastings Bridge, by actually building that bridge on the side of the river, we're able to keep the current bridge open to the point where this 47-mile detour really never had to be put into place. We kept the economy of Hastings alive. And I think sometimes that takes additional resources, but we think the impact outside of our department, which is the economy, is equally important and measurable. So we've again talked about our efficiency and what the goals are. The last legislature identified a goal of 5% of our state road construction budget That really is about 15% of what we view as additional resources. We said, you know what, we can start doing this now. We're not going to wait till we have additional resources to invest wisely. We're actually able to reprogram parts of the St. Croix Crossing using less of the right-of-way than was originally planned by compressing the footprint of the bridge, made it not only less impact on the community, but we are able to do it more efficiently. We freed up funding, and we are able to dedicate that funding to repaving parts of I-90 where the pavement was in really rough shape, and we didn't have the funding to reconstruct that amount of pavement. And I know, as a simple bus guy, it's a little disconcerting when you're driving on a state road and you see a sign saying, please drive on left side of road, you know, because the right side was in rough shape. So far this fiscal year, we're at about $36.8 million, and I can spend more time another day or happy to share with you how our methodology of actually capturing that savings and making sure we do it on a consistent basis and that we're actually using these funds to deploy on projects that otherwise couldn't be done. Having said all that about asset management and project scoping, we're not leaving operations without being part of the mix. We are looking at ways to what we do every day to do it more efficiently. I described the GPS system we use for salt deployment and managing our fleet, but a very sometimes simple ideas like the tow plows. Here's a picture of one. Where we're able to, I think it's $5 million a year. A significant benefit, because when we have gang plowing, where there's about six trucks that run down the road and clear a whole freeway, we can do that with one less truck. It actually has significant savings for both truck usage and fuel. So by purchasing some equipment, we're able to get additional value. And then we're looking at ways to look at other kind of technology solutions to find better efficiency. So what's been gratifying is a lot of the ideas that are very small, but they all roll up, are coming from every part of our organization. And we actually have a number of contests in our different divisions where employees come up with some good ideas to save money, and we try to incorporate it. In fact, we celebrate their use. One of the best efficiencies, there's a picture of the Hastings Bridge. One of the great efficiencies, too, is to making sure that we're meeting a maximum amount of what we're trying to achieve with a scaled-down version of the actual investment. Flexible design projects, we call them, and we actually won an award for the 169-494 and the 169 Snelling 10 projects, where we're able to not have a full cloverleaf. We have less highway, but we're able to meet 95% of the traffic needs, and by able to kind of scale back by sometimes as much as 40% the construction cost. So we want to be smart about how we build projects and have it based upon performance, not just we like to build stuff. That's not a technical term, but it's way I describe it. So a lot of times I've gotten questions about where's the money gone, and we've had a number of major bridge projects over the past 5 years, and you can see many of them listed there, and then many that are going forward. We have major bridge projects throughout Minnesota and the metro area. Here's some that we would hope to do in the future, and we see them as needed. As many people know, Minnesota River, Burnsville, Horton Crossing. And I've touched on these before. I realize some of this is redundant. The Corridors of Commerce, which many of you know, is both metro and greater Minnesota. These are extra lanes. They're passing lanes. They provide additional capacity. I've gotten questions about how we actually prioritize projects. I'll give you my quick overview. It really starts with that 50-year vision, which helps inform of what I call a family of plans. They're all, each mode has their own plan, including state and highway and bridge, but also transit and freight. And it actually, in terms of the highway program, gets into a very specific investment plan. And we look at a number of different criteria. Much of it is really metrics, performance-based systems, everything from concrete useful life to ROI determinants to safety data. And, you know, that's kind of a central view in terms of our statewide program, but also on the district level, there's also that balance of getting local input about what is really needed within a district, where are the priorities within a local area. So our state district engineers work collaboratively with transportation advisory committees, mayors, county engineers, to develop a program, which is really our state transportation investment plan. And that is actually a federal requirement, but we use it as a way to prioritize where our investments are deploying. The STIP, the State Transportation Improvement Plan, is always a rolling four-year plan. It can be amended, so it is really a guide. It is federally required, but it is one that I think is probably the most certain roadmap. And this is a good example of how we plan ahead. If we are planning projects to go beyond the STIP period, but definitely by the time they're in that four-year pipeline, we are pretty well along on projects to both plan for them, engineer them, and actually get them built or done. It is a very long timeline to manage these programs efficiently. And as you know, when you plan for something 4 or 5 years, it seems like so far away. But in transportation world, it's actually it's not that long, and it takes that amount of time to do all the environmental work and the engineering work. One of the questions we've had is about design build. I actually think this is a very important part of how we should conduct our program. Design build has a very specific way that we both choose a contractor, but also a very specific set of scoring process. We work with the AGC and with others, and as you can see, we have both a view toward cost and expertise in order to choose a winning partner. We've actually, I believe, come to not only accelerated project, but also real significant cost savings as a result of deploying a design-build process. This is certainly a process that is well known in the as I understand it, the vertical world. This is the horizontal world, and I think that we would see being particularly for difficult projects, making sure that we're actually working collaboratively with very smart experts in the field. We think that we get a much better result for the and a more efficient result for the citizens in Minnesota. Again, I'm happy to go through very specifics about how the scoring works, about how we have a panel of experts, and how we weight each score to make sure that we are being consistent and fair in determining what's the right proposal to accept. Like any time you're dealing with large contracts, there's people who have different points of view as to whether this is a right way to go, but I think we have confidence. Our engineers and our program managers have great confidence in this process, and we've worked at it over the years with our Association of General Contractors and others to try to find a way to make sure that we're transparent, but also being reasonable in how we can make the best choices for our large projects. not every project is really best for design-build. There are some that are smaller, others that are less complicated, and then doing a traditional, we design it and get the lowest bid, makes a lot of sense. So we don't think it's a cookie-cutter situation. We think different projects and different projects of varying complication take a different approach.
Mr. Sensor, I'll finish this one, then we'll got a couple of questions.
This just goes through an example of a scoring system on design build. So it's
okay. Since we're switching gears a little bit, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my question actually goes back to kind of some of the earlier discussion you had about when you were talking about surveying the employees, et cetera, about their ideas for saving money. Have you considered, taxpayers, of course, pay for construction maintenance of our roads, whether it's MnDOT or whether it's the county or whether it's a city government, townships, and others. Have you looked at, I know some states have looked at contracting with those local jurisdictions and realized by reducing redundancy, reducing miles traveled through contracting that the overall cost can be reduced. Have you looked at that in earnest? And anyway, that'd be the question.
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know in some states like Wisconsin, they contract with the counties, and the counties perform a lot of the work for roads. But I'm not an expert on it myself. I know that we have looked at ways to find greater efficiency through collaboration, sometimes with local governments. We haven't found the greater, and in many cases there are some, often some collaboration, particularly in greater Minnesota where you have common areas to have the public works, whether it's a salt shed or some of the equipment. But in many cases, the state roads has a specialized system, is the larger roads, and then county systems have different needs. They're more compact and have different kind of criteria. So I can't judge to be the total expert, and I can get back to you on the past. I have been told, because I've asked, just like you, I've asked the question, and I've been told that that some of our findings are that there isn't a great source of efficiency as you might think, because the needs are different. But I'm happy to follow up with you.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, and I look forward to that discussion. I know I live close to Wisconsin, and as you mentioned, it's working well for them. Just quickly, I want to know who in your agency to talk to about the silt fences that are built along every construction project, it appears, in Minnesota, many of which are built in areas where water would have to run uphill in order to hit the fence. And I'd like to figure out what we can do in that area. So who would I talk to in your agency?
Chair, Representative, our chief engineer has just raised her hand, so Sue Mulvihill can help. We make water run uphill, don't we? We can do anything, she said. No. So what a specific example we would be happy to look into and get an answer for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. And Commissioner, there's many out there. I'll get a picture for you, or maybe several when we get to summer. Thank you.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I understand, so much I'm still learning, but that there's a 3.5-cent debt service surcharge on the motor fuels excise tax. And so are there plans for paying that down, eliminating that? Where does that stand?
Well, I think in Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe in 2008 when there was a gas tax increase, it was 5 cents and then an additional 3.5 cents dedicated to debt service. But what is currently happening with our debt service policy is that we will not issue overall debt service to exceed the 20% of all of our revenues. The debt that has issued since that time is actually costing as much as 5.5 cents. So I think the overall needs of that entire 28.5 cents, that there's more debt service than than even that 3.5 cents. So I think that our needs are greater than the current resources, which includes the entire 28.5 cents, which is that 25 cents plus the 3.5 cents debt service funding.
Thank you.
But we are paying down the debts. So.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I know you've got decades of projects on your books, but I've been meeting with some of my local governments, and I happen to live in a county that has very few state roads. And when I was meeting with one of my city councils, they were telling me some of their businesses go out of their way to bring their clients different routes so they don't have to go over Highway 13 because of the, I guess it's not a very attractive road. So I don't know if that's something that's ever on your agenda or where that would fall, but just to think about something along that line. And then in our county, we have very few east-west roads, and almost all our major roads, I think, are pretty much county roads. So how can we fit in to maybe get a few more state roads around here?
Commissioner Zell?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's certainly something we should look at. I understand the Highway 13, although given the constraints we have toward maintaining the system we have, it's hard to think about expansion without really thinking through what that cost might be going forward. Having said that, we have been engaged in a number of what I call jurisdictional realignment scenarios to say where are there roads which are state roads, which really shouldn't be, and where are their county roads where they really should be state roads. And so we can certainly kind of look and report as to how jurisdictional realignment might work out over a long period of time. As you can imagine, whenever you're thinking about giving up roads, that's a really difficult process, and we do it from time to time, give backs. But I think it is something, at least as a starting point, to actually have a study of jurisdictional realignment is a helpful process. We should be understanding on a completely nonpartisan, biased point of view what makes sense in terms of traffic loads and maintenance. And so as we march forward, we're happy to share that information, and it may affect your area.
Thank you so much.
Representative Hornsby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Zelli. Back to page 13, where you were discussing in the slide on the funding gap, the resources needed for maintenance of our existing system. I seem to recall that MnDOT did a study about the amount of roads that will be in poor substandard condition by, I think it was the year 2020, and it was several thousand miles. So I'm wondering if that's still the case, and number one, and number two, if you could describe, maybe in lay terms, what does that mean exactly? We had a little wake-up call last winter about potholes, and when we talk about the condition of the roads in that report or your worries, is this Rice Street in front of the state capitol last March and April, where I think one of our colleagues described it as an obstacle course trying to get around craters? Is that what we're talking about if we don't do this maintenance and invest in that?
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I think that our pavement analysis shows we have as much as 4,000 miles going into the end of their useful life over the next 10 years. I think it's an appropriate way to think about useful life. It doesn't mean that the road is overdone and you close it, but it means that it really has, from a performance point of view, that particular asset, that road, that pavement, is really not going to perform at any standard, and potholes and degradation underneath will start to kind of fall apart. So you deal with that by patching, which is filling the potholes, but those are just patches. They are Band-Aids that ultimately would need to be refilled, so they become a very inefficient way to maintain a road. The thin overlays is one way to extend a life of a road, but it doesn't help the substructure. So personally, I prefer looking at service life because it looks at not just the top of the road, but it looks at the entire under substructure and how you would can best think about how long these roads can be, you know, the existing asset can perform. Sometimes we measure ride quality, so we think, well, we only have 9 or 7 or 6% poor roads in terms of ride. Well, we might have done a lot of thin overlays that only had that 3 years life, but you know, that's a lot different than reconstructing the integrity of the substructure, much more expensive, but those roads will last another 40 years. So if we are doing nothing but thin repavings, then we're just pushing a much more expensive problem down the road, theoretically, metaphorically. And so I think that the looking at service life of a road is a really good kind of way to look at the entire picture, and that's the metrics that we can share.
And, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Zelli, so the your studies, your pavement analysis is still pointing to this you know, major problem, you know, maybe beginning as soon as 6-7 years from now in terms of, you know, really needing resources to just maintain what we have already.
Mr. Chair, Representative Horstein, it is, and you could think of it a little bit as that post-World War II boom and then the big construction of interstates and highways in the 60s and early 70s, and now us boomers and our boomer roads are all coming of age, and so we're facing a kind of a life cycle of many of those bridges and pavements which need new hips new reconstruction.
Hey, Commissioner, why don't we continue with the we'll allow you to finish up here.
Sure. I'll go through this quickly. I know we spent time, and I don't mean to wax on too much, but you've had some specific questions about our employment. And this shows full-time equivalence because we have a number of part-time people and full-time people. And I think this kind of shows consistently where we've been over the past 10 years. And it's been pretty level employment at the agency. This is a budget history, so I think that kind of speaks for itself over time. And again, the use of bonding has been probably the most significant difference over the past 5 years, because we've addressed a number of bridges and major projects since 2007. You asked about our fleet size. This is not snow trucks, but kind of like almost everything else. This is cars and trucks, you know, it kind of bounces around that same level over the past, the past 10 years. And part of this relates to maintaining assets of fleets the same way as we maintain assets of roads. We try to keep an efficient average life so that they're not costing us a lot of maintenance just to maintain them. There was a question about off-site training and conferences with MnDOT employees. Probably the biggest off-site work we do in conferences is actually not a conference. It's probably our snow truck driver training, which happens at Camp Ripley at least once, sometimes twice a year in the fall, where we bring new employees and we actually train on-site at Camp Ripley. Is the most efficient way we have to actually get piles of salt, and they learn how to drive the big trucks in a safe environment. And if you're ever interested in watching that, that's a lot of fun too. There's been a number of kind of workshops, generally we don't have a lot of off-site activity except for some management workshops. And then they're never really done at resorts. I wish they were, but they're not. That's my question. I probably left some questions on the table, but I'm. Do you say we have more time?
We do have a few more questions. I have a general question in regards to budgeting. You had a slide in there for your STIP, the State Transportation Improvement Program. Is it safe to say that that's kind of your blueprint for the next 4 years then?
It is. It's a very specific set of projects. Obviously, sometimes projects will slip out of the STIP by being advanced a couple of years, or others might be accelerated. But it is more or less where we see our work programs happening. And particularly at the district level, each district engineer will really have a set of, some of them are very small projects, some are big, but it allows them time to plan for, communicate, engage with local communities, do the proper kind of scoping, engineering, and letting. So that really takes that 3 to 4 year time frame for almost anything.
I'm sure with the complexity of everything you're working with, that has to be pretty stringent and stringently followed. And I guess that's why I was wondering, from the budget perspective of moving forward, we really have that budgeted for the next 4 years then, right?
We have a sense of what that what those costs are. But as you know, the farther you are in the planning process, the less certain the number is. It starts to come closer, and we look at how we might, again, mitigate costs. But a lot of times what's in the STIP is driven by that constrained resource. I mean, we will only program as much as we have resources that we think we can spend.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you devoted quite a few slides here to the design-build process. And have you guys conducted any fiscal analysis on the amount of money that you would save by utilizing more design-build and how you could leverage that savings into more projects?
Well, you know, it's something we've done for a while, and we're really open to pursuing, but I'm not sure we've identified. I'm looking at Tracy. No. You know, it's something that we're looking at. It's more as projects come online, we see some, for instance, a particularly large project in the, up near the range, relocating Highway 53. That's a design build because it's a particularly very complicated from an engineering point of view in terms of timing, and it lends itself to that kind of approach. If it's a smaller project, we wouldn't. So sometimes it's a way to accelerate projects. So generally, we're looking at doing more, but we know that it's not necessary for every project.
Follow up? Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess generally speaking, it's a much faster track for a project and difficult to a little more difficult to control and manage. But would it be fair to say that most of the time you're going to end up saving money by utilizing this process?
Well, that's my impression because you work well with a contractor and a design team. There's no surprises if you're working collaboratively together. And you often might, you could design something and get the lowest bid and then miss something, and the change orders make it incredibly expensive. So it's better to have everything. It's my bias is let's get everything on top of the table, making sure that all parties are jointly incented to work together for the best result. And that's kind of how I see it.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, do we know what the dollar amount is to the state just to maintain our current levels of light rail that we have existing in the state?
Mr. Zilli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not so engaged with the Met Council activity. You mean the light rail transit, the green line and the blue line? I just don't have those numbers, but I'm sure they'd be happy to tell you.
Representative Kosnick, I'd just like to say that the Met Council actually is coming in Monday. We'll be able to ask those questions as well.
I'd answer, but it might be a different number, and that would really be embarrassing. So. No, I'm not. I honestly don't know.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because, as you said, those dollar amounts don't come out of your budget.
Right.
I've been, of course, feeling a little sympathetic to you today because almost all of the questions have a sort of a sense, do you think we could save money if we do X? Do you think we could do money if we save? I have the opposite kind of question. Since we were compared somewhat to Wisconsin today, I sort of recall that Governor Walker proposed that Wisconsin raise their wholesale tax on gasoline. So when we get further along in the session and begin to look at funding, it would be helpful to know surrounding states and maybe just generally what the nature of revenue increase is that we and how we might consider that. But my question is, going back to Representative Mason's issue, because I think there's an underlying frustration there that many of us feel. Turnbacks are usually the state wanting to get rid of some roads and turning them back to local governments. And I know you've requested a fairly significant bonding request there to do that. But what she's describing, I think, is another thing. As we've developed, and particularly where those millions of people are moving to, what seemed once to qualify as state, as city and county roads are now major, you know, like state thoroughfares in terms of volume of traffic and how it works in the system. And you hinted that maybe we should be talking about this, but I didn't get the sense that it's actually a lively conversation. But particularly as we talk about revenue increases, should we be so fortunate as to have that happen? It seems to me the kinds of questions she was raising are going to be essential. Does it really make sense to call some of these roads and bridges city and county streets anymore when they have become the major corridors of commerce in the very areas that's generating the bulk of the revenue? You know, the economic.
Commissioner Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, and as I alluded to it, I'm not an expert as to where we are on that, but I think we should be open to at least studying, and we are studying the whole jurisdictional realignment, alignment as it is, and is it serving its original purpose? I mean, there's some actual roads which are in the Constitution that will be state roads, and so there's some state roads which are really not having large capacity traffic. But we will have them. I know one that goes through Jay Cook Park, and I tried to give it to Tom Landau, our commissioner of DNR, and he smiles very nicely at me. But I think that in terms of these issues, the reverse, we should be looking at the larger picture and seeing how best we can manage that with the resources that we have, and we thinking about the. About some of our municipal cost participation policies is too another area we need to be thinking about, whether state plans, but it costs a great deal for local governments. We ought to be thinking about not just having a cookie cutter approach, but how does that affect our local partners? We understand and deeply appreciate that most of the roadways are counties and municipalities, and they're facing the same issues and the lack of resources, and so I think the idea of having a rational kind of conversation is would be a welcome idea.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Zelli. Going back to slide 18 and 19, which was your pretty pie charts with the revenue sources as well as the expenditures, I noticed that there's about a $50 million discrepancy, which we've raised $3.14 billion revenue sources, $3.09 billion in expenditures. And I think I know what the answer is, but rather than me making the assumption, do you happen to know where that other $50 million goes to?
It's not a private commissioner's reserve that I know of. My understanding is that because it's a snapshot in the middle of a biennium, that it actually spills into the they don't actually match. But if this were over a 2-year biennium period, you'd see it much closer. I'm now turning around. I just got a gold star from our CFO. I think that's the answer.
So basically, it could be unspent expenditures that are authorized for various years.
It might be there, but part of a budget that we're counting on for the next biennium. next fiscal year.
Thank you.
And a final question, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zelli, I love to sometimes sit around and hear some more of your bus stories because I bet you they're pretty good. Equally, I could tell you some aviation stories that would probably have your hair standing in. Speaking of aviation, 2 years ago, we changed the aircraft registration tax. Yeah. And being a pilot, I know that there's private and corporate aircraft that are intentionally based out of Minnesota, because over the last umpteen years, we've been so far off the scale as being uncompetitive for this. But now that the aircraft tax has changed, granted, I'd love to see more room on this, but do you have any follow-up on what has happened with the current aircraft registrations? Have they gone up? Have they gone down? As well as taxes that are being collected under the current revenue, the way it's set?
Mr. Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know that that was a very thoughtful process where we included a lot of the users of the system, because it really ultimately becomes a self-funding process. The funds are deployed through grants to the airport system. But I know it was just done. How would have, there's people in this room who will know whether there's more registration, you know?
There are additional registrations. We can get you specific numbers on that. And the revenue is coming in, but again,
Representative Anderson, I'm hearing that they will get that information to you.
Yeah, thank you. I'll get that for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Zelli. We appreciate your time today, and we look forward to visiting along the way. Members, we will be in the basement on Wednesday. We'll have freight rail economic development study, and then also an overview of the airports by MnDOT and Metropolitan Airports Commission.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.